Hello and welcome to the Deathcast. I'm your host, author, and journalist Ian Tott, and I'd like to thank you for joining me as we prepare to take our final look at the Ypsilanti Ripper murders. Before we get going, I have the normal show notes. If you'd like to follow the show on social media, just search for the Deathcast. You can also go to your favorite podcast app, follow the show, leave a 5-star review. And lastly, you can go to tinyurl.com/decast Patreon, where for as little as $1.99 a month, you can get access to early ad-free shows as well as exclusive content, just like my first two Patreon members, Channel and Anthony, did. Alright, now that all of that's out of the way, find yourself a nice comfy chair, kick back, and relax. I've got my coffee, I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt! When we left off last week, John Norman Collins had been taken into custody and was facing trial for having committed murder of 18-year-old Karen Sue Benneman. Ends up going through a number of lawyers as things wend their way through the whole pre-trial phase. His mother eventually is able to get one of the most expensive lawyers in Ann Arbor to represent him by taking out a mortgage on her house. This lawyer, Richard Winfield Ryan, would later state that he honestly believed in Collins' innocence, which is always a good thing when you are a defense lawyer. There are lawyers who just take the person's money, don't really care if they are innocent or not. But from everything I was able to learn, Ryan was not this type of lawyer. Eventually, Collins is going to make it to court. This is on September 5th of 1969, where he is formally charged with first-degree murder. Collins is noted as being mute in court, so the judge enters a not guilty plea on his behalf. The defense also moves to have certain aspects of testimony on the prosecution side barred, as well as to have the prosecution disclose all physical and scientific evidence that it possesses. Obviously, the judge allows the defense access to what the prosecution has. However, the judge denies the request to have the testimony barred from court. This is a fairly standard legal maneuver that most of the time that I haven't seen fails to work. Usually the judge will not disbar testimony. However, it does on occasion happen, as was the case with certain testimony in the Wayne Williams trial for murder in Atlanta. Court was adjourned until the 3rd of October. When court resumes, the defense continues to attack the prosecution's case, trying to get the judge to declare Collins' arrest illegal, which would make all of the evidence that had been gathered after that arrest inadmissible in court. They also attempted to get the judge to rule that the search warrants had been improperly executed and the items listed on the search warrants as having been obtained by misrepresentation of what was written on those warrants. They also tried to get the witness IDs of Collins as the man seen thrown out, as it became known that the sheriff, after Collins' arrest, had gone to the proprietors of the wig shop and shown them photographs of John Norman Collins in an attempt to get a positive ID on him. And the issue here became the fact that both of these women had picked Collins out of a police lineup after having been shown these photographs by the sheriff. Defense also pointed out that during this lineup, they had made Collins shift places with someone else in the lineup, thus bringing undue attention to him and almost, in the defense's opinion, ensuring that Collins would be picked out of the lineup. As for the warrants, the defense pointed out that no vehicle had ever been identified as having been involved in the murder of Karen Sue Benjamin, with the exception of a motorcycle. However, on the warrants, they wanted to impound and search Collins' Oldsmobile. They also listed on the warrants that they wanted to look for fingerprints of Mary Therese Flezar in both this vehicle as well as in Collins's apartment. Now, the problem with this is that Mary had gone missing and been murdered prior to Collins getting this car, and to the best of our knowledge, Collins was not living in this apartment during the period of time of Mary Flezar's murder. Also wanted to see if there were fingerprints inside of this vehicle belonging to the second victim, that being 20-year-old Joan Elspeth Shell. Again, this car that he was driving was not in Collins' possession during the time of either the first two murders. The judge informed the defense that he would take their motions to have all of this dismissed when court resumed on October 14th. However, he did tell the defense that Collins' arrest was in fact legal. Now, on October 14th, the judge ruled against the defense on all of their motions. The defense then requests of change of venue, which the judge refuses to allow. As for John Norman Collins himself, he had been in solitary confinement at the jail for most of the time since his arrest. However, once court proceedings begin, he ends up being placed into a regular maximum security cell, which allowed Collins to have visitors. Now, his aunt, the wife of his uncle, the state trooper, came and visited him once. However, she did not return after revealing to Collins's mother that it was she and her husband who had led to John's arrest. His other visitors included, naturally, his defense attorneys, one of whom, Richard Ryan, had begun to have suspicions about Collins's culpability in not only the Brenneman crime, but the other crimes that the police suspected him of. This was due largely to the fact that his alibi witnesses were turning on him. If you'll recall, the alibi witnesses that Collins had given were all roommates of his. Ryan was also discovering the various disturbing aspects of Collins's personal life that the police had discovered while they were investigating the case, and which eventually led them to place Collins as their prime suspect prior to arrest. This is specifically the fact that roommates could place him with a number of the victims. He was a notorious thief, was seen as a lecherous individual, and one young woman had informed the police that Collins had raped her after she refused to have consensual sex with him. All of this is going to weigh heavily on the minds of the defense, as is the fact that at least on two occasions, Collins had to be talked out of confessing everything to the sheriff's department, which we have seen before in both the Ted Bundy case as well as Jesse Miss Kelly. Obviously, if the defendant confesses to authorities, it's going to severely hamper their ability to defend them unless they can get that confession thrown out as admissible evidence. Because of this first near confession, Ryan is able to get Collins to agree to a polygraph examination, the results of which will be kept private from everyone save the defense team. Now, we don't know the actual outcome of this polygraph examination other than the fact that Richard Ryan was really disturbed by the results, which leads me to believe that either Collins failed the polygraph examination completely, or the results were inconclusive, but leaning heavily towards his having failed. John Norman Collins' mother ends up firing Richard Ryan over the implementation of this polygraph examination, as she wholeheartedly believed in her son's innocence. Collins' mother is then able to retain the services of one of the most prestigious law firms in the area at the time of Lousel and Barris, in the form of senior partner Joseph Lousel. And it's with this counsel, Joseph W. Lousel and Neil H. Fink, that Collins is going to go to trial with. Obviously, they're trying to get a change of venue. The judge isn't going to allow this. Court is supposed to resume in the early part of 1970. However, on February 11th, Lousel is struck by a heart attack, and court must be postponed until April 20th. Now, on April 15th, a grand jury in Salinas, California, heard all of the evidence against John Norman Collins and unanimously voted to indict him on this. Counsel for Collins in Michigan attempted to have this information suppressed in the fear that were it to become known locally that Collins was to be indicted in California, it might prejudice a already well-informed jury pool against Collins and thus make it more difficult for an impartial jury to be selected, but also for this jury to reach an unbiased opinion as to the guilt of Collins. Unfortunately for the defense, however, by the time that the Salinas grand jury was told of this and the local prosecutor had agreed to it, news of Collins' indictment in California had already made the national news services, so it was a rather moot point. This leaves Collins' defense to request another change of venue, which is again denied by the judge. Collins' trial officially begins on June 2nd of 1970. Just prior to the start of the trial, the counsel for the defense again petitioned the court to have the wig shop owner's testimony concerning their positive identification of John Norman Collins barred. Again, the judge refused this request, with the judge remarking that even though there had been irregularities in the identification of Collins by these two women, he did not feel, in his opinion, that the sheriff showing these women Collins' photograph as well as his movement during the police lineup had in any way, shape, or form adversely affected their ability to honestly pick Collins out as the man that they had seen on that day. There is a bit of fanfare that is going to occur concerning Collins's arrival and removal from court every day, as the jail is located across the street from the courthouse. The judge rules, however, that Collins should be brought into the courthouse under heavy guard every day, which basically means that Collins is going to be transported to and from court in an armored police van with an escort of sheriff's deputies, while the entirety of the street is to be closed down during both of these transfers. After jury selection, which consisted of the judge choosing 14 members, and then both the defense and the prosecution having the ability to void any of these selections, with the prosecution being given the ability to peremptory challenge up to 15 of these selections without an explanation. The defense, on the other hand, had 20 of these peremptory challenges, meaning that jury selection could have gone on, you know, for weeks on end. It took until July 9th for a jury to be selected. 12 jurists with 2 alternative jurors. There were 6 men and 6 women, 7 of whom had college degrees, 2 with some college, 2 with high school graduation, 1 who had made it to the 11th grade. Collins' actual trial begins on July 20th. In opening statements, the prosecution stated, quote, "The people will show that on July 23rd, 1969, John Norman Collins deliberately and maliciously took the life of Karen Sue Benneman," after which the prosecution quickly went through the points that they were going to attempt to prove to the jury. For the defense, Neil Fink spoke, basically saying that they were going to prove that the prosecution's case was built upon assumed notions, and that none of the evidence that was going to be presented would be able to definitively prove that John Norman Collins had been responsible for the murder of Karen Sue Benneman. Concluding with, "I am convinced that after you have listened to all the testimony in this case, you go into the jury deliberation room with total fidelity in your oaths, you will have a doubt, a reasonable doubt, a serious doubt, not a capricious doubt, and with that fidelity to your oath, you will return a verdict of not guilty." The prosecution began by calling Karen's roommates and family members, who detailed her disappearance. They also called the pathologist who gave evidence as to the cause of death and the injuries suffered by Karen Benneman by her murderer. After this, the prosecution began to insert John Norman Collins into its narrative with its next series of witnesses. Patrolman Larry Matheson, who was the individual who had gone to talk with Collins after recalling having seen him on the day that Brenneman disappeared, gave testimony as to what he had seen that day, and also his subsequent talk with Collins and his roommates. Other witnesses gave testimony that they had either seen or been approached by Collins on that day of July 23rd, 1969, that he had been wearing a horizontally striped shirt, driving a large blue motorcycle. All of those who stated that Collins had approached them were young college co-eds, while those who said they had seen Collins stated that they had witnessed him approaching young women while riding his motorcycle around the square. They also gave testimony that all of these encounters had taken place between 11:30 a.m. and 12:30 p.m. Now, the reason for all of this is the prosecution had a large map of Ypsilanti with the square marked on it, but also the dormitory where Karen Brenneman had left, and it became increasingly apparent to those witnessing the trial that the prosecution was trying to show that the most direct route for Karen to take would have brought her over to Ballard Street somewhere between 12:15 and 12:30. And the reason that this is important is, as testimony showed, Collins was also on Ballard Street somewhere between 12:15 and 12:30 on the afternoon of July 23rd, 1969. On the fourth day of the trial, the one-year anniversary of Karen's murder, the prosecution called the young woman that Collins had made a date to go swimming with on that date of July 23rd, 1969. This young woman told the court that she was a motorcycle enthusiast and that when she had encountered Collins, not on the 23rd, but on the 20th, he was driving a new motorcycle, a large Triumph, with no mirrors, that he said he had gotten during a recent trip to California. She went on to describe how Collins had swapped parts from his other motorcycles with this particular bike, and that it was something fairly common for Collins to do. The prosecution then has two Triumph motorcycles wheeled into the courtroom, both of which belonged to Collins, and she positively identified the blue one as the one that he was riding that day. The defense briefly cross-examined this young woman before resting. The owner of the wig shop then took the stand and told the courtroom of how Karen had come into her wig shop at roughly 12:30 on that Wednesday afternoon to pick up the hairpiece that she had ordered, and had told her that she did not want to leave with the man that had brought her there. She said that Karen was in the shop for 15 to 20 minutes. She stated that Karen had left the wig shop at 12:45 to 12:10 p.m. on that day, and that she had not seen Karen Sue Brenneman after that point. When asked if she had seen the man on the motorcycle afterwards, she stated that yes, she had, in a police lineup, and that she recognized him in the courtroom, pointing to John Norman Collins as that individual. Unfortunately for the prosecution, the defense was able to get this woman to stumble over herself on the stand, giving a number of possibilities or probabilities, but no definitive answers, as well as admitting that the sheriff had shown her pictures, as prior to this, she was not certain of the man's identity, before ending with eliciting the response from this woman that initially she had thought the motorcycle the man was riding on was a Honda. The next person to testify was a woman who had worked in the chocolate store next to the wig shop, who testified that she had seen the young man on the motorcycle wearing the striped shirt for 10 to 15 minutes starting at around 12:30 p.m. She was able to positively identify this motorcycle as having been a large Triumph, as she was a motorcycle rider. She testified that after a period of time, a young girl also wearing a striped shirt or blouse came out from the wig shop and got on behind the young man. On cross-examination, this woman stated that while she agreed with the general description of the man that she had seen on the motorcycle, she did not think any of the composite sketches that had been drawn up of the man matched the person that she saw. She also stated that she could not, even after having seen the defendant on multiple occasions, state with certainty that the man she had seen with Karen Sue Brenneman was in fact John Norman Collins. Next to testify was Arnold Davis. This was on July 27th. Now, if you'll recall, Davis was Collins' roommate, who Collins had attempted to persuade to give him an alibi by stating that he had been with Davis, showing him how to ride a motorcycle earlier in the day than they had actually been together. Under sworn oath, however, Davis stated that he did not see Collins until late in the afternoon, somewhere around 4 p.m. or later, at which point Collins had taken him to ride on the motorcycle. He stated that Collins had switched license plates and mirrors from his blue Triumph to the green prior to them leaving. Davis also stated that as they stood in the garage and Collins worked, he noticed that the blue Triumph was warm, as though having just recently been ridden on, while the green Triumph was cool to the touch. Arnold Davis then stated how after riding they had gone out for dinner with their other friend before returning to the house at round 9, and that at roughly 9:30, Collins had told them that he was going down to the garage to work on his bike, not returning until roughly 11:30, at which point they began watching TV, although Collins left again, telling them that he had to go feed his uncle's dogs, and that Collins had not returned until roughly 1 a.m. Before concluding his examination of Arnold Davis, prosecutor Deli asked, quote, about the motorcycle lesson the defendant gave you on the afternoon of July 23rd, did that ever come up again in subsequent conversations? Davis, yes, one other time. Deli, what was that occasion? Davis, it was the following Sunday night or early Monday morning. After James came back from questioning by the police, he told me to be sure to remember what time we'd gone riding that Wednesday, that it had been early in the afternoon. Deli, how early did he suggest it had been? Davis, about 2:30. Deli, and what time had it been actually? Davis, after 4:30. Those in the courtroom, including the prosecution, stated that during this last part of Arnold Davis's testimony, they noticed a shift in John Norman Collins' demeanor, as he had been fairly placid throughout much of the trial up until this point. However, as Davis began to describe how Collins had requested he give a different time should he be asked for one, Collins's face began to darken, growing increasingly agitated as Davis related this information to the jury. It was said that he glared at Davis, shaking his head and twisting his mouth into a silent no. His attorney, Neil Fink, had to place a hand on Collins' shoulder during this before attorney Lauzel stood and began his questioning of Davis. Lauzel, quote, Mr. Davis, did you yourself at first tell the police that you and James had gone riding about 2:30 or 3 o'clock that day? Davis, yes, but... Lauzel, then what caused or persuaded you to testify to the later time? Davis, I just decided to tell the truth. Lauzel, very good. Now I shall ask you if you had known, ever met or seen Miss Karen Sue Brenneman, the deceased? Davis, not that I ever recall. Lauzel, and as John's close friend, are you aware if he knew her? Davis, not to my knowledge. Lauzel, all right. Now, that night when James was hustled off by the police later, when he informed you that they seemed to regard him as a suspect, how did you react? Davis, I couldn't believe it. I thought he was joking. I mean, they could have suspected anybody who rode a motorcycle. Davis then recounts how Collins had told him that he would subject himself to a lie detector test. Davis then states that he did not see Collins again after this, as later that day the police arrived and asked Davis to come speak with them. We'll be back in just a moment. You've heard me talk about it before, peeps and freaks. Chinese Mandarin is the number one in-demand language globally in the international job market. And I have a brand new sponsor this week just for you. Chinese teacher Mary. Mary goes deep into learning Mandarin, much the same way I go deep into covering true crime cases, ensuring that every single student not only understands pronunciation and sentence structure, but that they can differentiate between tones, read the language, and speak it fluently. I have never come across another Chinese teacher quite like Mary. Because while she likes to have fun, and believe me, Mary is absolutely hilarious, she takes the job of teaching foreigners Chinese extremely seriously. So what I want you to do right now is go to tinyurl.com/ChineseTeacherMary, follow her, subscribe to her, come to her class, which is held 3 times a day. Support her and learn from her. Because I can almost guarantee you that after one lesson with Mary, you're going to realize that there is not a single teacher out there who is as dedicated to teaching as she is. Again, that's tinyurl.com/ChineseTeacherMary. Or just look for the link in the description. Hey there, D&Ders, your friend Ian here with another brand new sponsor this week. Artwork by Katie. Now, as the son of a fairly successful artist, I grew up around the art world, saw many different styles of art. I know good art from bad, and I can honestly say that in addition to being a good friend, Katie is one of the best artists I have ever had the pleasure of seeing. Her works of art, be it drawings or paintings, are absolutely amazing. And Katie doesn't just do original works of art, she also does commission pieces. So if you're looking for that perfect piece of art to offset the decor in your home, office, or even in your place of business, go check out Artwork by Katie at linktr.ee/KatieArtworks. That's linktr.ee/KatieArtworks. You'll be blown away. Davis says that he was taken to the crime center located at the seminary and that the police questioned him for hours on end, that the police seemed hung up on the mirror that was on Collins's motorcycle. Davis said that the only mirror he ever recalled seeing on any of Collins's motorcycles was an old beat-up round one that he was in the habit of switching back and forth between his various bikes. Davis stated that even after he graduated from EMU in early 1970 and moved to New York City, Michigan authorities continued to hound him concerning the statements that he had given police, as well as his need to cooperate with authorities, as there was a possibility that he, Davis, could be charged as an accessory after the fact in these murders if it was found that he was lying on any point of his testimony, or if he refused to go and cooperate and testify at Collins's trial. Davis evidently had enough of what he termed harassment by the Michigan police, and informed them in the early spring of 1970 that if they did not stop harassing him, he would be forced to seek legal counsel in order to get them to leave him alone. The defense then asked whether or not Davis had been offered any sort of a deal to testify for the prosecution against John Norman Collins, with Arnold Davis stating emphatically, "No, sir." The next day, Davis testified after a meeting between both the prosecution, the defense, and the judge as to having seen John Norman Collins removing a cardboard box filled with women's clothing and jewelry from their apartment, placing the box into the car of his trunk. Davis stated that this happened 2 days prior to Collins' arrest. Although Davis was allowed to give this testimony, he was not allowed to give any sort of a description as to what he had seen inside of that box. The defense was able to get any mention of the actual items barred from discussion at the trial, as some of the items that Arnold Davis stated he had seen were actually linked to other victims, and as Collins was only on trial for the murder of Karen Sue Benneman, he could not legally bring up any of the other murders in this trial. They then called Collins's other friend, Monte, who basically recounted the late afternoon and night of July 23rd, 1969. The defense had no questions for this man, as anything they could ask him might divulge the fact that both he and Collins had been involved in a series of burglaries. Next to testify was Collins's uncle, now Lieutenant David Leek, who gave a rundown of everything that had happened concerning everything that had happened upon their return from vacation, the discovery of the missing items in the house, as well as the later discovery of the stains upon the floor beneath the paint. They also elicited information from Lieutenant Leek that Collins had had a key to the house prior to their vacation that he had lost, that the Leek family had given Collins a new key, and that this key had never been returned. After this, Lieutenant Leek's wife, Collins's aunt, testified for the prosecution, telling pretty much the exact same story as her husband did. The next witness called to testify was the Leek's neighbor, Marjorie Barnes, who lived directly across the street from the family. She testified on July 30th, stating that on either July 24th or 25th, 1969, she had seen John Norman Collins leaving his aunt and uncle's home carrying a laundry box that was covered with a blanket. Later on that day, the head of the State Police Crime Laboratory, Sergeant Kennard Christensen, testified about the various forensic tests that had been conducted in the basement of the Leek household, that blood stains had been found in 4 separate areas around the basement, and that this blood had been matched by type to Karen Sue Benneman. Upon questioning by the defense, Christensen stated that while fingerprints had been found inside of the Leek basement, they were only partials, and that no full fingerprints belonging to either Collins or Brenneman were found inside of the basement. On July 31st, 2 witnesses testified about forensics indicating that the victim, Brenneman, had been inside of the Leak household. The first to testify was the head of the Michigan Health Department's Crime Detective Laboratory, Walter Hotz, who testified specifically about the hair clippings that were discovered in Brenneman's underwear, as well as in the Leak basement, stating that the hairs had matched each other exactly. Even under cross-examination, Hotz refused to bend on his determination. Following Hotz's testimony, Curtis Fluker testified about the blood type, stating that they matched the same type as Karen Sue Benneman, and that they did not further attempt to classify this blood, as the crime lab did not have access to equipment or technology which was able to perform these tests. The final prosecution witness was called on Wednesday, August 5th. This was a chemistry professor from the University of California named Dr. Vincent P. Gwen, who stated that in his opinion, the hair samples recovered from both the Leak household and from Karen Sue Brenneman's underwear bore a remarkable similarity to one another, and that based upon statistical calculations he had done, it was highly improbable that the hair found on Brenneman's underwear had come from anywhere else other than the Leak's basement. Obviously, the defense jumps all over this man, pointing out that a statistical analysis of this type had never been used in a court of law. However, Dr. Gwynn refused to back down from his assertions and instead stood by his conclusions. At this point, the prosecution ended its case. Prior to the start of the defense's case, they presented three motions to the court, that being to strike the testimony of Walter Hotz, pointing out that Hotz had testified that no one had ever before testified in court with such absolute certainty concerning the matching of hair fibers. This motion was denied. They then moved to strike the testimony of further forensic witnesses, stating that their testimony had been speculative in nature, as well as to strike any testimony referring to neutron activation analysis, which is the way in which they were able to match hair particles, basically meaning that they bombard these hair particles with neutrons, which activate dormant elements in the hair, such as, you know, iron, potassium, things of that nature. And by doing so, they were able to match these elements in one strand of hair with elements in another strand of hair, thus coming to the conclusion that the hairs were similar in nature and came from a similar source. The court ruled against both of these motions as well. The defense last motion was to have a direct verdict, which means that the jury would not get to decide on Collins's guilt. Instead, the judge would decide upon Collins's guilt himself. The judge responded by saying, quote, "I do feel that, of course, the prosecution's case is entirely circumstantial. However, sufficient evidence, circumstantial though it may be, has been produced so far in several areas which, if believed by a jury, could result in their finding defendant guilty as charged. The proof of the corpus delicti is adequate to go to the jury." Four of the five witnesses that the defense called worked at a motorcycle shop where Collins had gone on the day of July 23rd, 1969. While the time that the individuals gave all varied, the general consensus among all of them was that it was somewhere between 1 p.m. and 2:30 to 3 o'clock p.m. On cross-examination, however, this shifted to anywhere from noon to 2 to 2:30 p.m., and it was brought out that two of these witnesses had given written statements which they had signed, attesting that the time Collins entered the shop was roughly 2 p.m. These two individuals stated under oath that they had felt pressured by the task force into giving the time as after 2 p.m. and into signing both of these statements. This information was elicited from them by defense counsel. Final defense witness called on August 8th was Dr. Robert Jervis, who is a well-known neutron analyst, who stated that in order for hairs to be linked to one another, the general consensus was that at least 10 points of identification needed to be present in both sets of hair samples in order for a test to be considered conclusive in its findings that both sets of hair had come from the same source. Jervis stated that it was his conclusion, based upon the evidence that he had seen, that the hair sample retrieved from Karen Sue Brenneman's underwear was different from the hair that was found in the Leak household. The defense then recalled prosecution witness Dr. Walter Holes on August 12th to testify about the samples he had taken to a Dr. Samuel Gulub, who examined 20 photographic slides of samples removed from Benjamin's panties, which, according to Dr. Gulub, were found to have contained multiple man-made fibrous materials. The reason why this was important is because the sample presented in court from the Leak household was only found to have contained one man-made fibrous material. Now, we know with the advancement in forensics that this can be explained away as transfer from other areas, such as the perpetrator's clothing or car or the area where the body was disposed of, may have resulted in this discovery of further fibrous materials. And it's very likely that this did in fact occur, as we really don't know when Brenneman's underwear was placed inside of her vagina, whether it was before, during, or after her murder, or whether or not it had occurred at the Leak household or at another crime scene that we are unaware of. Under examination by the prosecution, Holes identified each of the 20 photographic slides that he had brought to Dr. Golub's laboratory. At this point, the defense asked if they could ask a procedural question of Holes, and the judge allows this. Counsel Lausel states, quote, "Mr. Holes, were these slides available to you at the time you testified a week or two ago?" Holes, "Yes, sir." Lausel, "I see." At this point, Lausel goes and speaks with the other attorney. The prosecution then moves to have these slides entered as People's Exhibit 81 through 100. The defense does not object to this. However, attorney Lausel says, quote, "I see I overlooked something." At which point, all of the slides were shown to the jury. Why is this important? Initially, it was said in court that only one man-made fibrous material was found inside of the panties. However, these slides showed that multiple pieces of man-made fibrous material were on Brenneman's underwear. So I'm going to break this down fairly succinctly. Some people on the prosecution side had testified that only one piece of fibrous material had been found. The defense's witnesses stated that only one piece of fibrous material had been found. Well, all agreed that multiple pieces of fibrous material had been found in the leak basement. However, Hulse had waited until July of 1970 to do a final analysis of these underwear. He stated under cross-examination that he wanted to be certain that all hair particles had been removed from the underwear prior to taking these final photographs for examination by Dr. Galoob, and that only after all of these hair particles had been removed had he taken these photographs using an extremely powerful microscope that revealed particles otherwise unobservable by either the naked or mechanical eye. And the reason he had done this, as during Dr. Jervis's testimony, Jervis had stated that there was nothing there except for this one fiber. So Hulse had gone back after this testimony was given and done a final thorough examination of the underwear, at which point he discovered these further fibers. Now, you might be thinking, you know, this sounds kind of sketchy that during the trial, this underwear is re-examined, but only after a defense witness states that no fibers were found on this underwear, and that upon re-examination, multiple fibers are discovered. However, Hulse stated that he was concerned by Jervis's conclusions and wanted to see for himself as to whether or not what Dr. Jervis had stated was in fact true. After giving this testimony, the state rested their case. Obviously, the defense is rather shaken by this last-minute testimony by Dr. Hulse. The defense strongly considers calling John Norman Collins to testify on his own behalf. However, under a mock cross-examination by Attorney Fink, Collins becomes extremely aggressive towards Fink, and it's decided that this will not do. As during this mock cross-examination, Collins had flown into a rage, scratching at the screen that separated himself and Fink, calling him a son of a bitch, and that he will smash Fink's mouth. Fink then decides to ask the judge if he can have Collins's mother speak to her. So the following morning, before court resumes, his mother speaks to Collins, and according to those who were present outside of the holding chamber, when Mrs. Collins came out, her eyes were puffy and she was crying uncontrollably, and Fink and Lauzel both felt that Collins may have admitted to his mother that he had in fact committed these murders. In any event, whatever passed between the two of them is only known to John Norman Collins at this point. The defense chooses to rest their case at this time, and closing arguments begin on August 13th, with the prosecution spending just about an hour going over everything that had been presented at trial as testimony, as well as all of the evidence Neil Fink presented for the defense, attacking the evidence and the quote-unquote facts that the prosecution had presented, stating that none of them really had been proved. Lousel then stood and spoke largely about the fact that the prosecution's entire case hinged on the conclusion of Dr. Holes, that it was possible to conclude from microscopic examination that hairs found on Karen Sue Brenneman's underwear, in fact, were the same as those found inside of the Leak household. Lousel then made a slip, as he stated, concerning the wig shop owners, quote, all they could really claim was that they saw Miss Brenneman with John, with a man on a motorcycle. To counter the defense's closing statements, prosecutor Booker Williams said, quote unquote, I don't know whether esteemed counsel's slip a moment ago was Freudian or not, but it was one of the few times in this trial that I have to agree with him. Witnesses did see Miss Brenneman with the accused, John Norman Collins. The case is put to the jury the following morning. They are only giving two options as to a verdict. One, that Collins is guilty as charged in the murder of Karen Sue Brenneman, or two, that Collins is not guilty in the murder of Karen Sue Brenneman. He gives the jury no leeway for, you know, second-degree murder or manslaughter. It's either first-degree murder or not at all. And they are out for a long period of time. If you don't know, oftentimes, counsel for both the prosecution and the defense are friends, such as it was in the trial of John Norman Collins. And speaking amongst each other, the defense for Collins admitted that they believed Collins was going to be found guilty of the crime. On August 19th, 1970, which is a Wednesday, the jury finally returned a verdict. They found John Norman Collins guilty of first-degree murder. Collins sat emotionless as the verdict was returned. Many inside of the courtroom gasped in horror at the verdict. Collins' mother and sister both fled the courtroom in tears. The judge sent sentencing for 8:30 a.m. on August 28th, at which point the judge asked Collins if he had any statements to make before he passed sentence. Collins said, quote, I have two things to say. I think they conscientiously tried to give me a fair trial. The jury did not take its task lightly, but I think things were blown out of proportion. The circumstances surrounding this case prevented me from getting a fair trial. It was a travesty of justice that took place in this courtroom. I hope someday it will be corrected. Second, I never knew a girl named Karen Sue Brenneman. I never had a conversation with her. I never took her to a wig shop. I never took her to my uncle's home. I never took her life. Afterwards, the judge sentenced John Norman Collins to life imprisonment without the possibility of parole. Collins is then eventually placed in solitary confinement at Southern Michigan Prison. Obviously, the defense files numerous appeals throughout the years. However, all of them are summarily rejected by the courts. The state of California decides to waive their extradition of Collins, as he had been found guilty of Brenneman's murder, and while initially they spoke of pursuing a case against him, charging him, and finding him guilty, citing Collins' then-ongoing appeals process, Collins will never be tried for another murder, despite the fact that circumstantial evidence strongly links Collins to the remaining murders that took place in Michigan, as well as the murder that took place in California. Many believe that Collins may have committed other murders that no one is as of yet unaware of, and this is very possible. Collins is really classified as a sadistic sexual psychopath type serial killer, with something about a woman refusing his advances or menstruating being a triggering factor in his decision to both murder and abuse his victims. However, it is highly unlikely we will ever know with certainty whether or not Collins has committed further murders. Now, further developments in this case: in October of 1977, Collins was transferred to the Marquette Branch Prison due to dealing in contraband drugs, as well as his planning an escape attempt. Collins was unable to participate in this escape attempt, which was successful, as he had a broken foot at the time. In January of 1979, it was discovered that Collins, along with six other inmates, had made a tunnel underneath the prison in order to escape. This resulted in all of the men being transferred to a more secure cell block in Marquette Branch Prison. In 1980, Collins legally changed his surname to that of his biological father, Chapman. He requested to be extradited to a Canadian prison, believing that by doing so, he would be able to get a release from prison at some point. However, while initially granted, due to Collins holding dual citizenship between the United States and Canada because of his father, the court eventually overturned this after extreme outcry from the public. Collins Chapman has repeatedly denied any involvement in the murders. In August of 1990, he was transferred to the Iona Correctional Facility due to repeatedly being cited as a troublemaking prisoner who dealt in contraband material. He's eventually returned to Marquette Branch Prison. On July 11, 2005, a man by the name of Gary Earl Letterman was charged in the murder of Jane Mixer. If you'll recall, Jane was the suspected third victim in the Ypsilanti murders. Letterman was found through DNA testing to have committed the rape and murder of Mixer. Throughout the years, Collins Chapman has refused any requests to submit to a public polygraph examination while still maintaining his innocence. He is currently housed at the G. Robert Cotton Correctional Facility, where at age 77, it is highly doubtful that this worthless piece of shit will ever be released. I hope that you guys have enjoyed my coverage of the Ypsilanti murders. Until next time, stay morbid!